Welcome to the new reality edition of Bite Marks Cafe right here on Hawaii Public Radio, where we serve you the first bite of today's science, technology, and innovation. I'm Bert Lum, and on today's show, we have John Sprague. He's the co-director of conservation over at Pulama Lanai. And we also have Lucas Fortini. He's with the U.S. Geologic Survey. And we're going to be talking about the Lanai Watershed Conservation Project. And I want to welcome you both, John and Lucas, to Bite Marks Cafe.
Great. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, no, it's great to have you guys both.
Great being here.
Now, you know, we've, well, I love the fact that we can, you know, have you guys call in. And, you know, John, you're on Lanai, so I'm glad you have a connection out there and have a stable phone connection to call us. You know, what we don't get to hear too much about is the work that you do, especially in this context of conservation. So I guess between both of you, I mean, I'll start with John. I mean, what is it that you do from a programmatic standpoint? And I know there's some, you know, at a sort of high level, you know, some of the islands like Lanai and Kaho'olawe, I mean, they've been subject to a variety of different kinds of debilitating situations where, you know, like, let's say you have deer and goats and they sort of wipe out all the vegetation, and you have ultimately just bare land that is subject to wind and rain, and ultimately you end up having, you know, major runoffs unless you somehow mitigate that kind of situation. So describe the situation that you're in, and then we'll get into some of the solutions for, you know, mitigating that kind of erosion.
Yeah, sure, Bert. Thanks. So, I mean, first and foremost, right, so top level, the conservation department with Pulama Lanai, our mission is that of the rest of the company, which is really fostering and supporting a sustainable island community. And when we think of sustainability, we really think of it from a social perspective, an economic perspective, and then also a natural resource perspective. Because, you know, if you're going to be on this 140-square-mile island with 3,000 people on it, if you don't have all those things in balance, you're just not going to be able to persist there. And, you know, you hit the nail on the head in terms of observing what is probably the greatest impact on the island, which has been the disturbance over the last couple hundred years that has really been fostered by a little bit of neglect and a little bit of, you know, extractive attitudes and agricultural processes instead of really respecting the land for what it is. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Lucas is going to talk a little bit more about some of the details, but, you know, one of the coolest things about his project is we actually have some numbers actually to put to some of that damage. So to give you a sense of it, less than 10% of Lanai is native habitat, and over 25% of the island is bare earth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that leaves that remaining percentage being heavily invaded, heavily degraded landscape. And that has largely, especially over the near term, been perpetrated by an overabundance of deer and sheep, by axis deer and mouflon sheep on the landscape. So they're not the only problem, but certainly one of the most significant ones. So your parallels to Kaho'olawe are in line with what we see in our situation today.
Right. And Lucas, maybe I'll ask you, how did you kind of get involved with specifically work on Lanai?
Yes. So, well, actually, I'm a biological researcher for the Pacific Islands Ecosystem Research mm-hmm. Center, who is actually, you know, we're a research center here in Hawaii that, you know, we have a lot of researchers that deal with a lot of, like, very applied conservation-related research. And, you know, I'm, by training, I do a lot of, like, remote sensing, spatial kind of ecology type of studies that are very applied in nature. So, you know, we ended up getting involved with this project because, you know, with what John and others were trying to get done in Lanai, one of the critical missing pieces of information was having that really clear idea of what's the state of the land and how we can monitor that changing landscape with, you know, with the impact of these threats that John mentioned, but also potential climatic shifts, but also most importantly, all the planned conservation efforts that they're going to try to be applying across the landscape. So we need to have, like, essentially a first good snapshot of what the land looks like now, and in the future have the methods to be able to determine how that landscape is changing according to all the efforts that are going on. by Paloma and I and others.
Now, John, you describe sort of percentage wise what Lana'i consists of. So it's 10% native, which is pretty good percentage, but 25% bare land, and I guess maybe the remaining, was that 65% is could be a combination of, let's say, development and non-native species and whatever is growing there currently. And with the mm-hmm. with the 25%, how would you describe the efforts to bring that back into some more, let's say, productive state? And when I say productive state, anything is better than just having bare land exposed to the exposed to the weather, right?
Yeah.
So
absolutely. Yeah, I mean, how do you restore ecosystem function, right? Because mm-hmm, in those mm-hmm. areas that are truly bare earth, the ecosystem isn't really functional, right? In terms of efforts of trying to remediate that damage, it's funny because the simple answer is the right one in this case, which is that it's all about the plants.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't matter if it's wind erosion or if it's water erosion. Ultimately, the thing that keeps the soil in place are the plants that grow there. And, one of the cool things about this project is, again, sort of starting to get some numbers to it. You think about the amount of forage that an average deer or sheep eats, and it doesn't seem like a lot. A 100-pound animal might eat 3 pounds of grass per day. But if you've got 3,000 animals on the 22,000 acres of project area that we're working on over on the Kuhiviakai side,
mm-hmm.
you're looking at 4.5 tons of vegetation that gets taken off the landscape every day.
Right.
And so you look at that impact and the cumulative impact of that day over day and year over year, and you really see that it's being driven by overgrazing of ungulates on the landscape. So, for managing that, the first step really is to get the ungulate population under control. And concurrent to that, and we can talk about tools on how to do that, but concurrent to that is then identifying the areas where you want to go in and do direct management actions to really mitigate those high sedimentation areas. One of the other projects as part of this program is work by a guy by the name of John Stock, who actually mapped out the sedimentation loads over on the windward side and the Kuhiviakai side of Lana'i. And so coupling that with Lucas's data really lets us go in and identify the 10% of area that is contributing 90% of the sediment downstream.
Now, I do...
Combination of PAP... Yeah, sorry.
No, I do want to have you maybe share a little bit about the thoughts about eliminating or removing or managing the ungulates. So I want to kind of hold that thought. We'll be right back after this short break to continue our conversation with John Sprague, co-director of conservation over at Pulama Lana'i, and Lucas Fortini from the U.S. Geologic Survey. This is Bite Marks Cafe.
Support for Bite Marks Cafe comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Anchor Systems Maui.
Welcome back. This is Bite Marks Cafe right here on Hawaii Public Radio, HPR 1. I'm Bert Lum, and if you're just joining us, we're talking to John Sprague, co-director of conservation over at Pulama Lana'i, and Lucas Fortini from the U.S. Geologic Survey, and we're talking about the Lana'i Watershed Conservation Program. And right before the break, I had John talking a little bit about, some of the maybe strategies about going about mitigating, the erosion. And John, you said that maybe 25% of Lana'i is exposed land. And one of the key things that are contributing to that is the axis deer and the ungulates that are sort of eating all the vegetation. And I think you were getting at the point where there's a lot of, there's a lot of them, right? There's a lot of ungulates that are eating stuff. And the challenge is, do you, come up with a program to remove them? Because the plants are never going to grow faster than the ungulates that want to eat them. So, what's the strategy to go forward with, kind of reducing that major sort of impact on the land itself?
Sure. So, our communication and our strategy has been the right number of deer and sheep in the right places. And on a lot of Lana'i, that means zero. So up on the watershed in areas where we have recharge into the aquifers, There is no need for deer and sheep to be in those areas.
Mm-hmm,
and so
mm-hmm.
putting in fencing and making concerted efforts to remove all of the animals out of those areas that are sensitive to grazing is a primary focus of ours. That said, there is still, deer and sheep are utilized very heavily by our local population. There's literally tons of venison that get put on people's plates every year. And so managing for a more sustainable number of deer and sheep in the areas that are more resilient to grazing is still also one of our goals. I think for tools, really what that means is it means putting in fencing on the landscape so that you can manage those densities in the right places and at the right time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting because you do have a population there. And, obviously that is a food source, right?
So, absolutely.
And ranching per se isn't really a business, is it, on Lana'i?
No, it's not. There have been a couple stabs at it. There is a, as with Kaho'olawe, there's a history of ranching.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Lana'i was a ranch for cattle and domesticated sheep before the first pineapple was put in the ground in the 1920s. So there is that history, but I think what most folks have found is that because the island is so dry and because of transportation costs, not economically feasible to really have a large-scale ranching operation on Lana'i.
So all the deer and sheep that you're describing basically run pretty free unless they're contained within a fenced area.
Correct.
And then in terms of the control, obviously you're going to keep them out of areas like the watershed that you want to protect. And then the fenced areas that they do kind of roam through, that's where, the community can kind of, for the most part, freely hunt for deer and sheep?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the hunting community is a key part of our management strategy.
Okay.
So part of the Kuhibiakai Project, one of the grantees is the Lana'i Culture and Heritage Center.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been an absolutely fantastic partner over the last couple of years. And what they do is they manage community hunts in that 22,000 acres. So basically, every day out of the week, we have community members going out there and really trying to remove animals and push animals out of these areas that are very sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's a double win. You get community engagement in a resource management that is important to them, that in many cases they rely on. And it means that we're not going out and euthanizing animals and maybe not making full use of the animals that are euthanized.
Mm-hmm.
These animals, when they get shot by the community hunters, they end up on people's plates. And
mm-hmm.
that's a win-win for everybody.
And with the program and the partners that you have, do you see improvement? Are you winning that battle to recover the land?
Yeah. I would say the trend in the deer and sheep population over the last 3 years has been very positive. And I don't have an exact number. People always ask, well, what are the number of deer and sheep on the island? And I don't have an exact number to give you. But what I can say is that island-wide, and especially in the areas where we've been concentrating management efforts, the herd has decreased substantially, probably by over two-thirds in the last 3 or 4 years. And that's as a result of a combination of both an extended drought, which limited reproduction in the herd,
mm-hmm.
but also really is because of the efforts that has been put in by members of the community, as well as some professional staff at really getting those populations under control.
Now, just out of curiosity, you haven't mentioned the feral pigs. Do you have pigs also on Lana'i?
No, we don't. We don't have feral pigs, and we don't have feral goats. Both of those species were introduced to Lana'i, and goats in particular became very much a problem. And the goats and the pigs were both eradicated. Pigs were eradicated in the 1930s or 40s, and I want to say the goats were eradicated in the 1980s and 90s.
Oh, okay. Well, just for the sake of saying it, I've got pigs coming up from my backyard, so.
We're fortunate enough to have them, for sure.
Yeah. Now, from a technology standpoint, and I think this is where I'd like to give Lucas a chance to talk a little bit about, the mapping of the island and some of the technologies that you use, and ultimately, how does the information that you glean gets used by folks like John?
Yes. So, as we talked before, I think, our project, our mapping project really was trying to address this need, you know, by managers on the ground. And it really, it was made possible by a confluence of factors, because the reality is that it may be surprising to some, but we have very limited vegetation or general like land cover mapping products for the state of Hawaii. And most of them are relatively coarse and at these very broad categories of vegetation or cover. So we really wanted to leverage the improving in machine learning approaches that mm-hmm. have been, you know, mushroomed over the last few years, the improvement of available data in terms of, like, better satellite, like a more modern satellite data, lidar data, airborne imagery, and so forth. The leveraging also of increased computational capacity. A lot of the times when you try to do some of these analyses and models, you're dealing with a huge amount of data, a huge amount of computation that sometimes just simply not possible. So it was really a confluence of all these factors that allowed us to really do this analysis at an island scale, at a very fine resolution, and resulting in these very detailed maps, which right now Lanai is sitting really pretty to the compared to the rest of the state. It's the only island that has species level mapping of land cover for the entire island, which, you know, our independent validations of our model show it was highly accurate. We got to drive, you know, me and John, a few months back across the island using our maps and like checking places out and seeing like, okay, this is really working. So it's really exciting to have a product like that. And I think it's exciting to think about how now this opens the possibility of this kind of work being done elsewhere in the rest of the island. But I think in terms of this project, this again is the first step, because we are also doing some change analysis to try to identify not only coming up with like the very great and precise image snapshot for current, but also starting to detect change across the landscape, because that's when we can start seeing, okay, where are the places that management's perhaps having the biggest impact? Which are the places where perhaps are the edge of invasion that maybe some efforts can be focused on to try to, you know, slow down some of that incursion of like invasive plants and so forth into like pristine habitat. So there's a lot that can be done with this data.
So Lucas, you got me thinking now. You said species specific and, you know, leveraging technologies like LIDAR. can you describe a little bit about, you know, are you flying drones over Lana'i, and is it the aerial footage is specific enough that you can actually, you know, discern what might be a native cotton versus, you know, something that's non-native? Or can you actually, you know, find the ali'i that's on the ground? I mean, how when you say your maps are very species specific, can you get down to that level of detail?
Yes. Yeah, so we did use airborne imagery, both a visual that was from planes. We didn't use drone imagery, but we also used like some airborne lidar imagery as well, and as well satellite. It was kind of a complex kind of a analysis. So that resulted in these maps that are species specific. In fact, one of our classes we were able to identify relatively well in these maps are a'ali'i shrubland, which is one of the main native cover classes we have across Lana'i. But we were able to do that only for a limited set of species, both native and non-native, because, you know, in teaching a model, you know, a machine learning model to identify these classes, you kind of need several instances of a given cover class for it to know really what to look for across the landscape. And so we definitely had some species that native species especially that we really wanted to be able to identify across the landscape, but their cover was just a little bit too limited to, you know, apply it. Yeah.
So what besides ali'i, what other, let's say, plant populations were for the most part easily trainable for your AI model?
So definitely from the native side, ali'i and uluhe were pretty good to identify. From the non-native side, we had, you know, strawberry, guava. Well, we had, let's say, we're also able to map eucalyptus, Brazilian pepper, or is also another non-native, and let's say, halicoa. Kiawe was also, we were able to identify all those kiawe lowland areas pretty well, and so on and so forth. So, yeah, we were able to identify several types of land cover classes. And again, now it's exciting because we can see how these are now shifting over time.
Oh, yeah.
Which,
no.
You know, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's great. And you know, I do want to, you know, give John a chance to kind of describe what are some of the methods by which you want to mitigate the erosion and start to recover with some of the native plants. So we'll hold that thought. We'll be right back at a short break to continue our conversation with John Sprague, co-director of conservation over at Pulama Lana'i, and Lucas Fortini from the U.S. Geologic Survey. This is Bite Marks Cafe.
Support for Bite Marks Cafe comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
Welcome back. This is Bite Marks Cafe. I'm Bert Lum, right here on Hawaii Public Radio, HPR 1. And if you're just joining us, we're talking to John Sprague, co-director of conservation over at Pulama Lana'i, and Lucas Fortini from the U.S. Geologic Survey. And we're talking about the Lana'i Watershed Conservation Project and some of the technology and techniques that are being used to manage the land that is currently kind of exposed and how to recover some of the native habitats. And so, John, you know, in terms of trying to, you know, now you've kind of identified with the help of Lucas some of the native ecosystems. You have you know, identified these swaths of 25% of the land that's kind of like exposed. What are some of the erosion control methods that you might be using to try to hold back the water, try to you know, get the soil to be more not blown away? You know, how do you get plants? Do you have volunteers coming in and planting native plants? I mean, what are some of the strategies that you're employing?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, one thing I'll highlight here is that, you know, Lucas's piece of the puzzle is absolutely crucial in starting to answer that question. And the thing I want to highlight here, too, is that within the program, within Kuahiwa Kai, is that Lucas's piece of the puzzle gets combined with a few others. You know, this sedimentation budget map that another partner is coming up with, you know, those two get married together because really the plants and the soils really inform each other. The other thing that goes and gets folded into them as well is we did do a drone thermal camera survey of the project area looking for deer and sheep. And so we actually have a very precise understanding of the current distribution of those animals. And as you might expect, those animals distribute themselves on the landscape in ways that are predictable based on the vegetation. So we can use Lucas's product with the deer and sheep FLIR data in order to get a more holistic understanding of how those things are moving on the landscape. And, I mean, if I can, you know, small tangent, but we also have some products from a couple of other partners with the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation and this grant program, including folks out of the University of Miami and the Nature Conservancy, who have very high-resolution mapping of the coral along the coastline, just below those areas where the sediments are coming down.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we have all of these products, all of these different ways of understanding how the things fold together because, I mean, as you know, it's an ecosystem. And so the plants and the deer and the soils and the water and the reef and the people, it all comes together into, you know, sort of one big holistic picture.
Now,
but you ask on, yeah, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, you ask, well, how do we start to mitigate some of that damage then? And really, you come at it from a bunch of different directions, right? So we've already talked a little bit. I think the key component is reducing herbivory, is reducing the number of deer and sheep on that part of the island. That's absolutely crucial. Another crucial part that, you know, you pointed to then also is including the community in helping to really stop that sedimentation, stop that flow of soils down into the reef. And one of the key ways we hope to do that is by targeting specific areas on the landscape that are more prone to erosion than others. We are currently working on a separate grant to build out a shade house on island, and we're partnering with another grantee. They were just awarded to actually start doing seed banking. So by the end of the year, they should be over here helping us to collect seed stock from native seed sources in order to produce those plants that can then be put out on the landscape in those high sedimentation areas. to really try to, you know, stem the bleeding.
Have you started to kind of enlist volunteers to go out and actually do some of the plantings?
Yeah, in a small scale, I would say, you know, a lot of the first portion of Kuhibiakai so far has been information gathering, so that we can really target our resources in a way that's efficient. I mean, technology for us really gets used to be as efficient as possible. You know, it is intrinsically interesting for Lucas to describe to us in great detail what the vegetation assemblage is on Lanai. But when we start to put that together with some of these other products, being able to identify where exactly on the landscape we want to put our effort is really going to make us more effective in the long run.
And in terms of some of the areas that are, you know, highly exposed, have you a solution or strategy in terms of enabling water to be available for any of the, you know, any of the plants that get planted?
Sure. You know, at this point, we're not really looking at actively putting too much water onto the landscape.
Uh-huh.
But I will say that, you know, that is a huge consideration for us for when the effort is put in. Lanai has a very variable wet season. It's a little bit harder for us to track the wet season. But what we do try to do is we try to time our outplanting so that we have a reasonably high chance of getting natural rainfall or fog drip or things like that over time. That said, there are also methodologies for trying to make microclimates that are more amenable to outplantings. So, you know, it's not just putting plants into the ground. It's potentially doing small bits of earthscaping in order to try to retain what water does fall in the landscape. And I can't stress the importance of plants in the water cycle to begin with. The origin story for Lanai, you know, the hero of Lanai, from when the island was named, you know, the name Ka'ulau translates into a grove of trees.
Mm-hmm.
So the importance of plants on the landscape for the water cycling, you know, the rain does follow the forest. And so we need the plants on the landscape to bring the water and the water to grow the plants. They're all interrelated to each other.
No, this is a really, you know, great, great story. And I would be really excited to see some of the successes and maybe some of the best practices that might result from this. So, you know, John, where can people find out more about what you folks are doing? And they can go and sort of research it on the web.
Absolutely. So if folks want to look up Kuhibiakai, and that'll direct them towards the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation page, who's a huge partner of ours. They can find the information there.
Sounds great. And I'm really excited for you folks and really wish you the best. And I'd like to have you guys back on, and maybe we can talk about some of the, you know, great lessons learned as a result of this journey. John Sprague is the co-director of conservation over at Pulani Lanai. And Lucas Fortini is from the U.S. Geologic Survey. And I want to thank you both for joining me today. And of course, thank you for listening to Bite Marks Cafe. Join us next week when we'll find out more about the UXHI conference about user experience and user interface. And okay, again, thank you for listening to Bite Marks Cafe. If you miss any part of this edition, you can find the podcast of tonight's show on bitemarkscafe.org. Our engineer is David Chong. You can catch us on HPR One every Friday or anytime via the HPR app or your favorite podcast application. In the meantime, you stay safe, you stay awesome. We'll see you next week on another edition of Bite Marks Cafe.